The 2020 presidential election is looming on the horizon. Many fear the outcome will be hotly disputed, and the U.S. Constitution probably won't help us out of the mess.
The Constitution, regrettably, one of its defects is it provides no mechanism for reliably determining the winner of a controversial presidential election. So I believe we need to create that mechanism, and sooner rather than later, or else we're going to find ourselves in another crisis that might even be worse.
That's Alan Hirsch. We talk with him about his book, A Short History of Presidential Election Crises, and How to Prevent the Next One. Then Bernie Sanders has indicated he's probably done running for president. What's next for the political revolution? Micah Utrecht discusses the book he co-authored with Megan Day, Bigger Than Bernie, How We Go from the Sanders Campaign to Democratic Socialism. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. What if, on account of COVID-19, we try to hold the 2020 presidential election entirely online or through the mail, and it turns into a logistical nightmare? Not that the alternative, in-person voting, is any safer for the vote or for our health. What if hackers succeed in changing votes from one candidate to another, calling into question the accuracy of the electoral count? And what happens if our current president doesn't accept Election Day results if he's not declared the winner? It will cause a crisis the likes of which this country has never seen. In 2000, we learned that an exceptionally close presidential election can produce chaos because we have no reliable constitutional mechanism for resolving disputes. Constitutional scholar Alan Hirsch addresses the problem in his book, A Short History of Presidential Election Crises. He takes us through a concise history of those crises and proposes some common sense solutions, including abolishing the Electoral College and creating a permanent, nonpartisan presidential election review board to prevent or remedy future crises. Well, Alan Hirsch, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book is A Short History of Presidential Election Crises and How to Prevent the Next One. I want to start with the Electoral College because I was really struck by the fact that you called the Electoral College a recipe for fraud and chaos. So where did the Electoral College come from, and why is it a recipe for fraud and chaos?
So it comes from the Constitution. The founding fathers, this is a bit of a simplification, but they mostly didn't trust the masses to elect the president. They wanted the good old boy network of white male landowners who were public-spirited and politically involved. They would be the ones casting the ballots for president. The reason it's an invitation to chaos, obviously now the situation has changed. We still have the Electoral College, but all 50 states have elections to determine who those electors are and who gets those electoral votes. So we really have presidential elections really consist of 51 separate elections, the 50 states and the District of Columbia, and the results are aggregated. Now, the reason it's an invitation to chaos and fraud is very simple, and it comes down to this. The Electoral College produces squeakers. We get all kinds of very close elections throughout American history because of the Electoral College. Whereas if you just counted up the votes, how many votes each candidate got, the elections would not be as close. The perfect example is 2000, where we had virtually a dead heat in the Electoral College and specifically in the state of Florida. Whichever candidate won that state would get the most electoral votes. And therefore, all the chaos flowed from that dead heat. But if you just added the votes nationwide, there was a 500,000 margin separating the candidates. Our most recent election, 2016, is another excellent example. Donald Trump wins by small margins in three states that give him the win, whereas nationally, Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes than Trump. And we find this throughout history. We get squeakers in the Electoral College where a few votes changing hands in one or two states would give a different verdict, a different outcome. but nationally, it's not that close. So ask yourself, if you're a hacker and you have the capacity, as some hackers apparently do, to change votes from candidate A to candidate B, what would you rather have as a system where you could affect the outcome? One where all you had to do was change a handful of votes in one state, or one where you had to change several hundred thousand votes? And the question answers itself.
And that is a very serious question. But this also obtained even before we had hacking. What happened in the election of 1876? You compare it to the 2000 election.
There are uncanny similarities. There were three states in question, one of which was Florida. And amidst voter suppression and fraud, similar things to allegations you would get in 2000, no one knew for sure who had won, the Republican Rutherford B. Hayes or the Democrat Sam Tilden. And to make what is a fairly long and really rather engaging story short, Congress tried to settle this dispute by appointing a commission of 15 people. 10 of them would be congressmen, split 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, and then 5 Supreme Court justices. And they had a brilliant solution, which was going to be 2 Democratic justices, people appointed by Democrats, 2 who were appointed by Republicans, and the 15th member of the commission. And therefore, the way of assuring that there was a fair outcome was going to be Justice Davis, who had no affiliation with either party. He was a notable independent. For complicated reasons, he ended up not serving on the commission. And the commission had a kind of what we would call a partisan lean, 8-7 in favor of the Republicans. And wouldn't you know it, every controversial issue solved by the commission was resolved by 8-7 vote favoring the Republicans. And Rutherford B. Hayes becomes president. Just to back up one second, I mentioned the commission. The commission effectively made Hayes president, but the Constitution requires Congress to actually receive the electoral votes and certify them. And Democrats were making noise that they were not going to go along with this because they believed the commission had been stacked. And then what happens? There's some backroom dealing, there's some conversations and some reassurances, and the Democrats lie down and allow Hayes to become president. So it clearly was not a model for how we want to resolve controversial or crises elections.
So you mentioned the partisan decision. Relate that to what happened in 2000. How did partisanship play a role there?
So here, instead of a 15-person commission consisting of congresspeople and Supreme Court justices, you had the 9-person Supreme Court that ended up resolving the election, 5-4 in favor of Bush. Many believe a partisan decision, certainly a decision that the Democratic Party did not accept, a decision that created issues of legitimacy. And in fairness to the Supreme Court, someone had to decide the election. And none of the other alternatives were any more appealing. It could have been the Florida legislature. It could have been the United States Congress. It could have been the Florida courts. None of these bodies would have been any more trusted, maybe even less than the United States Supreme Court. So one of the things I call for in the book is a commission that is truly impartial, in fact, tripartisan, Democrats, Republicans, and at least one member, an odd number of members who are affiliated with neither party, but a commission that is established before the election. Whenever you have these ad hoc solutions, where we wake up the day after Election Day and we say, we don't know who's going to be president, and we have to come up with some way of figuring it out, you get a solution that people are not going to accept if they don't win. And so the Constitution, regrettably, one of its defects is it provides no mechanism for reliably determining the winner of a controversial presidential election. So I believe we need to create that mechanism, and sooner rather than later, or else we're going to find ourselves in another crisis that might even be worse.
But the issue of the partisan control of elections goes far deeper than just the Supreme Court. You know, in 2000, there was Catherine Harris, Republican Secretary of State, who put the kibosh on a fairer count of the elections. You had in the 2004 election, again, a Republican Secretary of State who has been widely seen as putting his thumb on that election. You had recently in 2018, Stacey Abrams loses by a very, very small margin to a guy running for governor who is a Republican Secretary of State and who has been widely criticized or charged with a huge amount of voter suppression of Democratic candidates, especially those who are lower income and African American. So do other countries allow for this level of partisan running of elections? And how do we get out of that?
Well, so as you point out, you can have these kinds of shenanigans in state elections too. What Catherine Harris did and the entire machinery in Florida, which of course was under the helm of Jeb Bush, brother of one of the candidates, was no better than what the United States Supreme Court did. And that's what I mean when I said that the alternatives to the Supreme Court deciding the election were even worse. The fact that Stacey Abrams had that situation in Georgia speaks to the fact that many states, too, do not have reliable means for resolving a crisis election. However, some do. And I discuss in the book the 2008 election in Minnesota for United States Senator, in which Al Franken and Norm Coleman finished in basically a tie. It was a lot like Bush and Gore in 2000 nationally. We just didn't really know who won. And there were controversial ballots. They weren't hanging chads, but there were these absentee ballots which weren't filled out perfectly or didn't arrive on time. And you needed a bipartisan commission to resolve those issues. And it happens that in Minnesota, the solution was in place because they had a similar disaster in 1962 in their governor's race. So they actually put in place a way of handling the situation, and they handled it fairly reasonably, such that even the partisan Republican newspapers, when it was over and their candidate Norm Coleman lost, acknowledged that it was a fair process. That is exactly what we need. We need to model what Minnesota did, not in all the details, but the general idea of having a truly impartial commission that can be trusted, that we need that, and we need it in place before the next election.
How could that come about?
Well, think about it, Francesca. This is something that ought to interest everyone. Who should be opposed to a reliable means of resolving a crisis? Democrats, Republicans, they don't know who's going to be the beneficiary of a fair commission because they don't know who will legitimately win the election. We all should be able to get behind a reform which enables a reliable means of determining who won. So, you know, we have now many months before November, and although a constitutional amendment would be needed to have the perfect solution or as close as you can get to perfect, by statute, we can create a commission. Think about people like Colin Powell, who would be trusted across the aisle. We could put in place a commission in which people like him would have the authority to subpoena documents, hold hearings, and implement remedies necessary in the event of another crisis. That might mean calling for a revote if there's a complete disaster. It might mean changing the date of the election if the coronavirus or something else makes Election Day unfeasible. There are all sorts of things that could happen, and we are not equipped to deal with any of them.
I just want to push back gently on Colin Powell because I vividly remember him lying barefacedly to Congress about the weapons of mass destruction that Iraq had. So this is a complex issue. There are many facts here. One of the things you talk about in this book, Alan Hirsch, in A Short History of Presidential Election Crises and How to Prevent the Next One, is the two-party system. You know, other countries have ranked choice voting, which allows for more than just the two parties. But when you just have two parties, and which, you know, some people like Ralph Nader really call one party only in two different flavors, isn't that fundamentally a real problem in our democracy? That we actually, there are many ways. There's voter suppression, as you point out in this book. There's actual electronic voter machine hacking. There's gerrymandering, which it seems neither party is all that interested in changing. It seems to me that there's something more fundamental here at work.
Well, newsflash, we can't solve all the problems of the world in one book or one conversation. But I am sensitive to the two-party duopoly and the problems that creates. I mean, my book is limited to presidential election crises. So the two-party system, I'm not going to undo two centuries of experience. We have a two-party system, and we're going to for the foreseeable future. But what we can do is have a tripartisan commission decide crisis elections. So I specifically say we need people on the commission who belong to neither party. But you're right, gerrymandering, voter suppression, these are all serious issues, and they're not going to be solved by the presidential election commission that I call for in my book. They're not going to be solved by abolishing the Electoral College, which I also call for in the book. But I think you'd agree that the latter is an important structural change. That's not tinkering around the edges. That would change fundamentally the way we elect the president.
Yeah, and so explain that. The Electoral College, you know, a lot of people say, and you deal with this in the book, you know, that, well, you have to protect the small states. That's why it came about, although you kind of torpedoed the idea that that's how it came about. So what do you say to those who point to that it protects the voters of small states?
So two answers. First, the Senate protects the interests of small states. We don't need the Electoral College. It's already the case that Wyoming gets the same number of senators as California. And across the board, the equal representation, despite population differences, ensures that small states will be protected. So why do we need the Electoral College to protect the small states? Well, the answer Electoral College advocates give is if you didn't have the Electoral College, the candidates would never visit the small states. Who is going to go to Wyoming, which has 1/55th of the population of California? There just aren't any votes there. But if they have three electoral votes, now suddenly it's worth the while of the candidates. So this argument is fundamentally flawed in a number of respects. I remember, just as a personal aside, during the 2000 election, I would hear this argument. Candidates wouldn't visit Rhode Island and Montana and Wyoming and Nebraska if you didn't have the Electoral College. I was living in New York at the time, and I thought, well, they're not going to visit New York now, and they're not going to visit California or Texas, except maybe for fundraisers, because the Electoral College means that the entire election comes down to those handful of states which are swing states, which tend to be the same states with minor variation from election to election. So those are the states that the candidates visit, the large swing states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. You can bet that Donald Trump and Joe Biden, if the virus abates, God help us, and there is campaigning, those are the states they're going to be in, and maybe North Carolina and Georgia. They're not going to come to the other 40 states, small or large. So it's a bogus argument, just empirically. The Electoral College does not attract the candidates to the tiny states. And just to circle back to my initial answer, it's the Senate that suffices to protect the interests of those states. So, and the reasons to get rid of the Electoral College, you know, we know most of them. It's counting different votes differently. It's got other issues. But that's not what I argue for in the most part in my book, because those arguments have been made. I introduce a new argument. And it brings us back to the very beginning of our discussion and your first question. The Electoral College invites fraud. It invites hackers. It invites chaos. And that is a really important reason that has not really been thought about, that we should be eliminating the Electoral College.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about hacking. And talk about the hacking, because I think that's an extremely serious issue, and it's not just down to Russia.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked, because I've obviously been doing a lot of interviews now with my book coming out, and I'm constantly asked about the effect of the coronavirus on the election, and can states go to voting by mail? Can they do it in time? What are the problems if they do it? I get all those questions. And at a certain point, I get impatient and say, you realize there were problems before this virus existed with presidential elections? Amazingly, it's as if everyone has forgotten that in our last elections, we know the Russians and others, probably including domestic entities, tried to and to some extent succeeded in hacking our election. Now, they did it through Facebook and they did it through the release of emails, but we also know that there are hackers who are interested in and have the capacity to change the votes from one candidate to another. What else do we know? That the Senate, led by Mitch McConnell, has refused to pass legislation which would empower the states or enhance their ability to guard against that kind of cyber penetration. And that is a scandal in its own right. So clearly, hacking is one issue. What happens if there's a terrorist attack on election day or the day before, destroying the election infrastructure in many states? What happens if even a calamitous weather event, a flood or a hurricane, makes it impossible for some states to vote? What if the virus does, in fact, make it impossible for on-site voting? There are so many things that can go wrong with our elections, some of which we know are likely to happen if we take no action. And I feel like Paul Revere running around screaming, another election crisis is coming. And it's just so hard to get people's attention unless you're focused on the coronavirus. That people are paying attention to, and they should be. But that is not the only thing that can cause problems with the November election.
And absentee ballots, you know, which may very well be the remedy, are not necessarily protected either.
There are all sorts of logistical problems. What happens if they arrive late in the case of ballot by mail? What happens if the signature of the voter on the ballot doesn't match the signature on record? What happens if they don't perfectly indicate the candidate they voted for, sort of the absentee ballot equivalent of the hanging chad? There are any number of logistical issues with the tabulations of the vote, with the mechanics for how that would all work, because most states are not prepared for that. So while we should be looking at voting by mail, and while we should be encouraging it, it's not a panacea. And there may be problems that it brings with it.
What about the idea of scrapping the winner-take-all allocation of electoral votes in favor of proportional allocation? You write about that in this book, Alan Hurt.
Yeah. I think that's a great idea. I mean, just think about if California, one of the candidates wins it by 200 votes, they get all 55 electoral votes. Does that make any sense? And if one candidate wins it by a landslide, a 60-40 margin, as will quite likely happen, they get the same 55 votes. It makes much more sense to allocate the electoral votes in proportion to the popular vote. Now, I have to say, you're right, I do treat that in the book. I don't dwell on it, because I would rather we get rid of the Electoral College altogether. But the proportional allocation would be more democratic than the winner-take-all system, and it would also reduce the incentive and ability of people to commit fraud. Because now, if you change a few hundred votes in California, you're only changing a few hundred votes if you had proportional allocation. Whereas under the status quo, you could change 55 electoral votes just by monkeying with the ballots in one precinct.
Yeah, that's important. So you have actually two remedies. One is abolishing the Electoral College, and talk a little bit about the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact in that. And the other one was the one that you spoke about before, Presidential Election Review Board. Are they dependent on each other? Tell us first about the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. This is something that's already underway.
So the Electoral College, it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, to amend it, to abolish it through constitutional amendment, because the small states, although I think wrongly, believe that their interests are protected by the Electoral College. So you're just not going to get enough states for a constitutional amendment, which you it would seem that you need, because the Electoral College is established by the Constitution. But there is this movement started by some very shrewd law professors and a few political activists who recognized that you could actually get rid of the Electoral College without formally amending the Constitution if enough states, which means states whose combined electoral votes total 270 or more, if they agreed by a compact with one another that they would have their electors vote for whichever candidate won the national popular vote, now you would essentially be getting rid of the Electoral College. That would guarantee that the candidate who gets the wins the popular vote nationally becomes president. And right now, there are a number of states who have signed on to this compact, and they total something like, the last I checked, 200 electoral votes. They're still well short of 270. And we're not going to get to 270 in time for the 2020 election. And there are some problems with this compact. I don't mean to suggest that this is a panacea. So I would much prefer a constitutional amendment. But this compact that you referred to is an alternative method of going to a national popular vote.
And so then the Presidential Election Review Board, you say either one or both together. Explain.
Right. So abolishing the Electoral College would, among other advantages, reduce the ability of foreign actors, of hackers, of fraudsters to affect the election. So that's a great thing, and I think we should do it. But as a separate matter, we have this issue, even without the Electoral College, we could have an election that is so close that we don't know the winner. We wake up on election day and we don't know who the president is. This has happened four times in American history. It could very easily happen again. And that's why, to deal with that situation, whether or not we abolish the Electoral College, we need to establish a permanent, impartial commission given the responsibility and powers to resolve election crises. And that, I call it the Presidential Election Review Board. I discuss how it could be done by constitutional amendment, in other words, what such an amendment would look like. But we don't have to wait for an amendment. In the next several months, Congress could pass a bill establishing such a commission. It wouldn't have all of the powers that could be established by constitutional amendment for complicated reasons I discuss in the book, but it still would be far, far better than the status quo, in which if we wake up on election, the day after election, without knowing who the president is, we're going to have Florida all over again. And who thinks that that was a sensible, fair, impartial, reliable resolution?
Well, I love the idea, but I can't help but think of Mitch McConnell, who will not even pass the most basic kind of reforms ensuring that our election systems themselves can't be hacked. I mean, he won't pass any of the bills that the House has passed for electoral reform, and not to speak of voter suppression in the Supreme Court. So how do you see this getting from A to B?
Well, you're right. It's a grim prospect when the Senate Majority Leader is not even advancing legislation to safeguard against hacking. But suppose he were sitting in this room with us. I would say to him, Leader McConnell, picture the November election in which Donald Trump and Joe Biden, they're within one state of winning the Electoral College, and that state happens to be a blue state. Do you want to leave the election up to the machinations of the blue state governor and legislature? In other words, we don't know which party will benefit from an illegitimate election. So it's in the interest of everyone to have a fair means of resolving such an election. Am I confident that Mitch McConnell, were he to read my book, would say, you know, you're right, let's pass that legislation right now, creating a Presidential Election Review Board? No, I'm not that naive. But I do think there is an argument to be made that ought to convince any fair-minded person.
Alan Hirsch, we've been talking about your book, A Short History of Presidential Election Crises, and How to Prevent the Next One. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
It's been my pleasure, Francesca. Thank you.
Alan Hirsch is chair of the Justice and Law Studies program at Williams College. Next up, what's bigger than Bernie? Find out after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice, in-depth progressive conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Bernie Sanders suspended his presidential campaign, a lot of people asked, what's next for the political revolution? But the goals of the movement behind him were never just about winning the White House for Sanders. They've always been about creating a mass, multicultural, working-class movement to uplift ordinary Americans and get them involved in the political process, not just in elections, but in building real power on the job and in communities. That revolution is already underway, as evidenced by the massive growth of the Democratic Socialists of America, the teachers Bernie motivated to lead strikes across red and blue states, and the rising new generation of radicals in Congress inspired by his example. In their book, Bigger Than Bernie, Micah Utrecht and his co-author Megan Day provide a roadmap to the movement to remake American politics from bottom to top. As activists themselves, they analyze the prospects for long-term change and offer strategies for making the political revolution more than just a campaign slogan. Micah Utrecht is a labor organizer in Chicago, an assistant editor at Jacobin, and an In These Times contributing editor. Well, Micah Utrecht, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me back.
So now we're talking about the book that you co-authored with Megan Day, Bigger Than Bernie, How We Go From the Sanders Campaign to Democratic Socialism. You published this book, actually came out before Sanders ended his campaign. And you very clearly say, by the time the reader is reading this, you'll know if he won or not. But you start out by saying that win or lose, he's redefined what's possible in American politics. Tell us briefly, how would you sum up how he's redefined what's possible?
Well, the most important thing that his campaign has done is show that the lie that we've always been told in American politics, that Americans will never go for socialism, they'll never go for anything smacking of left-wing politics or class struggle or anything like that, that's not correct. That millions of people were inspired to act because of Bernie's campaign, and they were inspired specifically because of that bold message of left-wing politics that he was putting forward, that was a clear alternative to the kind of tepid neoliberal centrism of the Democratic Party that we've come to associate with that party at its top levels for the last few decades. And so if nothing else then that we get out of his campaign, it's that message that those of us who are socialists or other kinds of leftists who have argued for those policies for a long time, we're not crazy. We actually can have a mass constituency for our politics. Now, of course, that's not to say that those politics are winning, at the highest levels. I mean, obviously, Bernie just lost. He did not win the nomination. So there's a long road to travel before Bernie's politics are, dominant in American politics. But we have a foothold that we've seen through his campaign that those kind of politics actually resonate in the United States. And so it's not just his campaign, of course, it's the things that have come out of his first campaign, especially. I mean, the rise of the Democratic Socialists of America is an important force in the United States politics. The election of people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib and other left elected officials around the country. So there's a real sea change in American politics that has been evinced by his running these two campaigns. We have a very, especially if you've been on the left for longer than the past 5 years, you know that the left was very much in the wilderness for decades in this country. And we're not anywhere near power, but we have a newly relevant position in the country to advocate for things like Medicare for All. And so things are bleak for the left, as they usually are, but they're far less bleak than they used to be, and we have a viable path forward.
I guess I want to push back just a little bit on that, because when you say he's redefined what's possible, I could cynically say he's also shown us what's not possible. In other words, being nominated by the Democratic Party, which used every single trick in the book to deny him the nomination. I mean, I think if it had been a free and fair election, he may well have won. But they did whatever they could to stop him, from elections shenanigans to manipulating committees to having really, really bad apps that denied him votes. One of the central points of your book is grappling with how to use electoral politics, although it's also very much about building the movement. So we will talk about that outside of electoral politics and also the interplay between the two. But I just up front would like you to talk a little bit about, how the donor elite that basically runs a Democratic Party, you know, is part of an oligarchy that's not democratic. We don't really have democratic elections. How do we work within that framework?
Yes, this is a key point. And I think that the campaign, the campaign lost because of that apparatus that you're talking about. I mean, I think more than, you know, people are trying to parse the lessons of the campaign and parsing them, like, what did Bernie and his campaign do wrong? I'm very open to having those conversations, but I think the most important thing to take from this campaign is that the Democratic establishment, the Democratic Party's power players, its friends in the mainstream media, those are the key reasons why Bernie lost this campaign. And in this instance, those power players proved to be more powerful than the movement that Bernie was building, and we have to be sober about that. But I also think that that establishment has faced a challenge that it is totally unprepared for. To defeat Bernie, it's really a Pyrrhic victory. I mean, they have hurt themselves. I mean, look, for example, for young people for whom this is their first national presidential election, especially, or this one or 2016, they see a candidate like Bernie who is arguing for some pretty basic stuff, for Medicare for all, for free college for everybody, free public college for everyone. And they see this Democratic Party establishment moving heaven and earth to try to destroy that agenda. And they think, what does that mean about this party? That's a party that's supposed to be a left-wing party, the party of the people, that when a candidate who is not arguing for the dictatorship of the proletariat or anything, he's arguing for some very basic things that other countries have. What does it mean about that party that they are willing to do everything that they did in order to destroy him? And what does it mean that they put up somebody like Joe Biden? I mean, Biden, really one of the weakest candidates, potentially a weaker candidate than even Hillary Clinton was in 2016. You know, they put him up. They're championing him rather than Bernie. So I think that they've done great damage to themselves in destroying Bernie's campaign. Of course, all of this, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not the kind of opportunities that I'm talking about can actually be taken advantage of, and whether or not this establishment, if it really is weakened, and if that weakening can be taken advantage of. I mean, obviously, all of that is, you know, the next part of what the left in this country has to figure out how to do and how to push against. But I think that we at least have an opportunity, a better opportunity than we have had during any of our lifetimes, to actually accomplish those things and to actually continue push back and potentially defeating the establishment that unfortunately in this case was successful in its efforts to defeat Bernie.
Well, Micah Utrecht, you say in this book, Bigger Than Bernie, that what he helped to set in motion, although of course not just him, but he did he really brought it to a higher level, was building a mass multiracial, multicultural working class movement. And he did put the class struggle front and center. And I wonder if you could talk about how that building of that movement, the not me, us, the idea of social solidarity as opposed to the atomistic individualism of the neoliberal value system, how much that has really actually resonated and shown the potential for building the movement you talk about.
Yeah, I think there are two important things to discuss on that front. The one is just the general sense that he put forward in the campaign that we can build a different kind of society, one that, as you mentioned, is not totally atomized and neoliberalized on a sort of individual level. I mean, to personally, for me, the one of the most important and moving aspects of the campaign was at his Queens rally with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, where he talked about, I forget the exact line, but he said, you know, look around you, in this park in Queens and look at the people around you and see how they're different from you. And will you commit to fighting for someone who you don't know, someone who is different from you, someone who is different racially or religious background or gender or sexual orientation or whatever? I mean, that was a kind of almost a spiritual call to get beyond that kind of atomization and fragmentation that our society has in our world has been characterized by over the last couple decades, at least. So I think that was very important. I found that really inspiring, that ethic of solidarity that he was trying to inject into our politics. But then also the thing that was so unique about the campaign that he ran was not just that he, that there's this political spectrum and here maybe an average progressive politician is here on the spectrum and Bernie's just a little bit left of that person. It's not just that he was a little bit left, more left than your average candidate. It was that he was talking about doing politics in a different way, a qualitatively different way in this country. He was saying that what needs to happen if we are going to affect the kind of change that we all know that we want, what we share and wanting to achieve in this country, that we have to build movements to win those things. We have to get millions of people involved in grassroots social movements. It's not just about electing a Bernie Sanders, somebody who is uniquely moral and capable and good. It is also about changing the way that we do politics in this country and getting people who are not currently involved in politics involved in politics. It was a theory of social change that we have, as far as I know, never heard in American politics, at least from somebody who actually stood a decent chance of becoming a nominee of a major party for president. And so obviously there were many parts of that didn't come together in the way that could have carried him in this election. Clearly the US has not been built big enough yet in order to achieve all that we need to achieve. But there are really promising signs of that. I mean, as I mentioned, the Democratic Socialists of America is reborn as the anchor of this new 21st century socialist movement. We have organizations like the Sunrise Movement pushing for a Green New Deal. There are all kinds of newly born or reborn social movements that have come out of his campaign, and people who have, disparate social movements that came together to work for his election during this campaign. And so that's where I place a lot of my hope in the years and decades to come. If we're going to, emerge out of the coronavirus pandemic without just complete immiseration of our entire population, if we're going to avoid the most dystopian possible outcomes of climate change, we're going to live decent lives in the future. It's going to be incumbent on those social movements to fight the continued building of the US, of the not me US. Of course we're not there yet, but we have a promising start, I would say, that has come out of this campaign.
A lot of people since Bernie gave up his campaign, there are a lot of folks who say we cannot work with electoral politics. You differentiate between status quo electoral politics and class struggle electoral politics. So give us the difference and tell us why it is worth our while to engage in class struggle electoral politics, even if we lose.
Well, we've seen from the Bernie campaign a number of really important things that should tell us a few things about elections and a certain way of doing elections. I mean, one is the most basic point that this choice between we're going to either do elections or we're going to do social movements is actually a false choice because of the kind of campaign that Bernie ran, social movements, mass movements, the labor movement, etc. in this country are coming out of this stronger than they were before. Bernie's campaign helped infuse energy into those movements rather than somehow sapping them of energy. And we talk in the book, the people who make these kind of arguments that electoral politics are a waste of time, they're a dead end. I mean, they're not totally wrong because there is a long history in this country of electoral politics doing exactly that, sapping social movements of their energy, people, going into the Democratic Party hoping to, carry the energy of these movements, but then the Democratic Party apparatus really destroying their idealism and destroying their progressive commitments and all the rest of it. So that is a real danger. But Bernie went into this election. I mean, for one thing, he did, as I mentioned, he constantly said over and over that it was not enough to just elect someone like him, that those movements had to be built. He also used his campaign infrastructure to support those kind of movements. He used his, you know, texting of supporters in a given geographic area. Now I live in Chicago, for example, and there were multiple times when workers were going on strike in Chicago, and I would get a text on my phone from the Bernie campaign, not asking me to donate $27 to him or something, but saying, this group of workers, you know, at the University of Chicago is on strike right now. Can you come out to their picket line on such and such a day and such a time? You know, immigrant rights protests that were happening around the country. He used his campaign infrastructure to support those things and to turn his supporters out to support that kind of organizing. I don't know of any recent examples of that ever being done. We make a case in the book for class struggle electoral politics, in which we say that we need a kind of electoral politics that names and shames class enemies. You know, that says that the reason that we don't have nice things in society is because a small number of very wealthy people are hoarding all of the resources for themselves. This in Bernie's case was obviously the constant talk of the millionaires and billionaires. We heard that, you know, on the campaign trail all the time. It names and shames class enemies. It unites people, you know, it unites the working class around its areas of common interest rather than dividing people. And it strengthens social movements. And I think that, you know, on all of those points, Bernie's campaign did all of that. It didn't accomplish it in its totality, but especially on the question of uniting the working class. There's obviously a lot of work that still needs to be done. I mean, Bernie did not win over the kind of numbers of black voters, in particular older black voters, that he needed in order to win the nomination. So there's a lot of questions that we have to ask ourselves there. But overall, on all three of those counts, he's done all three of those things. And he's shown that supposed dichotomy between social movements versus elections is a false one if we run campaigns the right way.
So one of the campaigns that was run the right way and also was incredibly lucky, I think, too, was that of AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who was endorsed by DSA, Democratic Socialists of America. Rather than talking about her campaign in particular, I would like you to connect the dots between her win and the successful fight over Amazon in Queens as a way of showing how elections, when they are successful, can really make a difference. And then after that, we'll talk about elections that aren't successful that are also making differences.
Right. So we have a chapter on case studies of recent local and state level and national, in the case of AOC, elections that were successful. And we say they were successful in some cases because the candidates won, and in other cases, despite the fact that the candidate lost. And the New York example is a really interesting one that hasn't been talked about enough. In New York, there were two socialists who were elected in the time between Bernie's first campaign and this one. One was AOC, obviously, who was elected to the House representing parts of the Bronx and Queens. Another was State Senator Julia Salazar, who is also a DSA member and somebody who really comes out of the DSA. And they were two people who were elected, you know, again, one in the State Senate and one in the House. And what was done in New York was not just the product of socialists winning and then doing everything themselves, all the good things that happened coming out of their elections. Socialists played this key role as part of a broader progressive and working class effort to change politics. And so those socialist victories came at the time of the effort to displace the IDC, the Independent Democratic Caucus. I'm not sure the exact name of the acronym there, but they were the group of state senators in New York that were Democrats but were caucusing with the Republicans and were blocking any kind of progressive change from happening in New York at a state level. And Andrew Cuomo, you know, it allowed him to say, oh, my hands are tied because we can't get the kind of majority that we need in the state Senate in order to make the kind of progressive change happen. But as a part of the displacement of, I think, half a dozen of those IDC members, the socialists were elected. So there was and that effort was carried out by progressive organizations and unions in New York. socialists also were playing a really key role in changing the discourse in the city and state of New York about what was needed in that state, you know, talking about affordable housing, talking about stopping corporate giveaways. And lo and behold, when Amazon announces that it wants to move its HQ2 to a new city and lists Queens, Long Island City in Queens, as a potential location for it, AOC takes this really strong stance against Amazon coming there and coming and being given billions in public dollars in order to do it. Says that Amazon doesn't need that money, that the people of New York need that money. And we go through in the case study the sort of blow by blow, which is a long and complicated story. But the end result is that because of this role of socialists, you know, really taking strong stances against Amazon and socialists as part of a broader progressive movement, they stop Amazon from coming to Long Island City and from getting those billions of dollars in public giveaways and stopping the displacement that would have happened of working class New Yorkers in Queens and all the rest of it, as well as then later after that, the major housing legislation that was passed that gave renters in New York new protections, stopped evictions from happening as easily, gave new protections to rent stabilized apartments, gave some real housing protections to renters in a city that, as we all know, where prices are out of control and there's been enormous working class displacement in recent years and decades. So it's an important case study to talk about because, you know, it's not just like infusing our discourse with, you know, new progressive ideas. It was literal, tangible progressive victories that were won because of the work that socialists did as part of a broader progressive coalition.
Yes, they were successful, and they passed a lot of great progressive legislation in New York State. And yet, again, one step forward, one step back. New York State just passed the most draconian austerity budget, I think, in at least in the history that I know of. And this is a legislature that is now all Democratic, that completely caved to the austerity budget of Governor Cuomo, who slashed $2.5 billion out of Medicaid in the middle of a pandemic, and who keeps on saying, we can't do anything because we don't have any money. And nobody says to him, why don't you raise the taxes on the billionaires who can well afford to help those who are most vulnerable at this time of pandemic in this state? So the legislature just rolled over and let him do it all. I wonder if you have a comment on that.
My only just slight correction would be not nobody. If you read Jacobin magazine, you would have read New York DSA members decrying Cuomo for that budget and doing exactly that. But yes, your point about how despite these left upsurges taking place, Cuomo is still able to do whatever he wants. I mean, the budget is really just like morally abhorrent what Cuomo has done, coming at a time where he's getting all of these plaudits from liberals around the country that he does not deserve. I mean, this budget that he has passed is absolutely brutal. So it's a testament, obviously, to the point that we are not yet where we need to be in terms of building the kind of movement that can stop an Andrew Cuomo from ramming a budget that is full of cuts that are into some of the most desperately needed services at a time of pandemic. You know, we're not there yet. No one should mistake the newly promising avenues that we have to change the world for us winning, because we're still losing and losing pretty frequently, losing more than we're winning, which is a familiar place for the left to be, but it's a really depressing one nonetheless. So, you know, we talk about the impact of one socialist in the New York State Senate, and that impact is real, but it also shows when Cuomo does something like this, it shows like, oh, maybe one socialist elected official is not enough in the state Senate to stop the worst of the worst from happening. So, you know, total sobriety over our continued weakness is needed. And when something like Cuomo's budget passes, we are all rudely reminded of it.
So now let's talk about, you know, what happens when people lose. You have a very interesting case study of a fight in the East Bay. There was an election where a DSA candidate lost, yet there was a real movement that was emboldened and became stronger as a result of her candidacy. So I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, so my co-author Megan Day is from the East Bay and participated very much in that campaign that was for a state assembly for the candidate who was the DSA candidate was Jovanka Beckles, who's someone who has a long history in Bay Area progressive politics, who's a former member of the Richmond City Council, a rank and file Teamster, a social worker, as well as a queer Black Latina immigrant who ran for a state assembly seat against Buffy Wicks, who is really a kind of paradigmatic centrist, you know, millionaire and billionaire backed pro-corporate Democrat, somebody who came out of the Obama and Clinton campaigns, who ran the California state campaign for Clinton in 2016 and was nicknamed Buffy the Bernie Slayer for her work to try to destroy Bernie's campaign in that state in 2016. And the short version of the story is that East Bay DSA was the principal force behind Jovanka Beckles' left-wing campaign for the state assembly. It ultimately ended up losing, despite the chapter really throwing everything they had into that campaign. But as soon as the campaign was over, the East Bay DSA chapter used the infrastructure that had been built from the campaign. And the infrastructure that they built was immediately transitioned into supporting the Oakland Education Association strike. It kicked off a few months after the end of the Jovanka Beckles campaign in Oakland, an Oakland teachers strike. And East Bay DSA, according to the teachers union, played the key role in supporting that strike when it happened. I mean, everything from, you know, socialists getting up at to be on a picket line at 6 a.m, you know, driving all around the city to reinforce the picket lines wherever they were needed, serving meals. They raised an incredible amount of money, I think, in the tens of thousands, if not over $100,000, to feed teachers and students during the strike. We're responsible for all kinds of, like, you know, art and for protest signs and all of these things. And, you know, the union was very clear that it was the socialists who played a key role in supporting them during that strike and you know, strengthened the teachers' strike by their actions. And so all of that infrastructure came directly from the Jovanka Beckles state assembly race. And so, you know, again, speaking to the point that it is possible to do elections in such a way that those elections can strengthen social movement organizing, labor organizing, that is what happened in the East Bay after their state assembly race. And then their chapter is, you know, still using that infrastructure that came out of that state assembly race to continue doing social movement organizing. So it's a promising sign and a sign of what you can do with a campaign, even if you aren't able to win the election that you were organizing around.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Micah Utrecht about the book he co-authored with Megan Day, Bigger Than Bernie, How Do We Go From the Sanders Campaign to Democratic Socialism? One of the other major issues you take up is the issue of reform and revolution. You know, traditionally, some people have seen them as contradictory. You say it really depends on which reforms are chosen to work on, that there are particular criteria in mind. So in general, what is that criteria? You know, how do we fight for social democratic reforms and still promote socialism? And then I'm going to ask you more specifically about some examples of that.
You know, this is obviously a longstanding debate on the left. If you go back to Rosa Luxemburg talking about reform versus revolution, you know, Luxemburg herself says that it's a false dichotomy to say that we're going to either do reforms or we're going to do revolution. The day-to-day struggle for reforms is how you build the working class in order to, you know, it needs to build its power in order to fight for potentially more radical reforms. We argue for something that you know, André Gorz, the late French socialist thinker, once described as non-reformist reforms, or you could call them revolutionary reforms. You know, there are reforms that would change people's lives, that have a tangible effect on how people are living, but they are reforms that put the working class in a better position to fight going forward. So an example of such a reform is something like Medicare for All. If we won Medicare for All, it's not just that Americans would have access to healthcare system that they currently are denied or that currently puts them into incredible amounts of debt. It's that that Medicare for All would take unions, for an example. Unions currently spend an enormous amount of time and resources fighting for good healthcare policies for their members. And in fact, union members are some of the only people in the American working class who have decent healthcare plans. If that was taken off the table, if unions didn't have to worry about fighting for healthcare every time they had a contract expire, they could be empowered to be fighting for other things. Maybe they'd be willing to strike more often because they wouldn't have to worry about losing their healthcare when they go on strike in the way that workers currently do. And so the point of the fight for a sort of non-reformist reform or for a revolutionary reform is about choosing fights that don't just win gains for workers, but actually empower them to fight for more, because that's what we're obviously aiming for here is, you know, the empowerment of workers themselves to fight and to transform society. And so the reforms that we fight for should empower them to do exactly that.
And another point you make is that the demands that a socialist movement needs to have are for universal social programs. You know, there are an awful lot of the Democratic candidates at the beginning of the presidential campaign for the nomination who said they were for Medicare for All, and then it became, well, Medicare for some, and then it came from Medicare for all who want it. Or the same idea, you know, there, Pete Buttigieg, as you pointed out, you know, got on his high horse saying, why should we be giving free tuition to everyone? The rich can afford it. Why are universal social programs so key to building the power of the working class?
Right. This is another key thing, I think, to come out of the Bernie campaign, that means-tested social programs have become slightly anathema in American politics, at least among some of us. That's become a new common sense among especially people who are inspired by Bernie's campaign. The reason is because means-tested social programs are weak social programs, weak both in the sense that, you know, you have to jump through a million hoops in order to access the social programs, which means that less people use them. And they're also politically vulnerable. A good example of this is public education, right? In this country, we have already decided long ago that every single person deserves free public education K through 12. You know, that public education is obviously under attack. It's being privatized, et cetera, but we have that as a kind of fundamental core issue. We don't say that people who are wealthy don't deserve free public education because they can afford it. We know that when you've got everybody bought into the public education system, then it's harder to dismantle the public education system, which, by the way, is part of the reason why it's been so hard for privatizers to dismantle that system, because it, you know, public education is such a sacred public good in this country. And we need to expand that elsewhere. I mean, like in healthcare or Social Security, right? Like every American has, you know, the right to Social Security. It doesn't matter how wealthy or poor you are. You're supposed to have the right to Social Security. And that has meant that when Social Security comes under attack, as it has many times over recent decades, both Republicans and Democrats who have wanted to privatize it have found it very difficult to do so because there's such widespread agreement that this is something that we need to preserve in society. So we need to expand that elsewhere. I mean, that's obviously at the heart of Medicare for All. It's at the heart of the fight for free public college. And I always find it strange that people like Pete Buttigieg make these arguments that, like, oh, well, we shouldn't be paying for Donald Trump's kids to go to college. Well, Bernie's proposal was for free public college, right? Are Donald Trump's kids going to, like, you know, Brooklyn College? Are they going to like SUNY Plattsburgh? Like, no, they're going off to these elite Ivy League institutions. And so we're not going to be giving away, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in public education to the children of the rich, who probably are just going to choose to not take advantage of those free public institutions. But making them universal and making them available to everyone creates like a durable constituency that can fight for those goods. And the Democratic Party has really embraced means testing, and you could see it in the the campaign, obviously, the presidential campaign. But I'm hopeful in coming out of this campaign that Bernie has made universal social programs a key part of what it means to be a left progressive candidate going forward. And hopefully that will mean that we'll have more universal programs, not less of them in the near future.
And so finally, let's talk about your vision for socialism, because I think a lot of people said, oh, Bernie's not a socialist, he's a social democrat. And they, I said this, you know, he's an FDR Democrat. But I think, you know, you convince me that he's more than that, because FDR lived in a time when the progressive, in fact, you know, the workers' movement was quite strong. And in fact, FDR came in to save capitalism by accomplishing these social democratic reforms, whereas now we live in a time of neoliberalism where the fight for social democratic reforms can build that very movement. But going beyond that movement, what is your vision of socialism? How could it work here?
Well, I agree with Karl Marx about not wanting to write, as he called it, recipes for the cookshops of the future. In other words, you know, we should work out together in a democratic way what exactly our future socialist society should look like. And I could, you know, list out a couple of the key points for what my socialist society would look like. But I also want to work with other people together to create that society. But you know, on the point of what, you know, whether or not Bernie was actually a socialist or not, what Bernie did in his campaign is essentially what we call in the book, stealing from our boss, Megan and I's boss, Bhaskar Sankara from Jacobin, was class struggle, social democracy. In other words, he was fighting for FDR type policies, right? He was not fighting for the dictatorship of the proletariat. He was saying we need a public health system and free public college and all the rest of it. But his route for getting there was through class struggle, was through getting millions of people engaged in mass movements and fighting for them. I mean, you know, you remember during the campaign when people would ask him, well, how are you going to get, you know, Mitch McConnell to do X, Y, Z? And Bernie would say, well, I would show up in Mitch McConnell's backyard in Kentucky, and we would have, you know, huge numbers of people demanding. I mean, this is not the typical stuff of American elected officials. This is not how most of them talk about making social change happen. And so that commitment to that kind of social, you know, action or to win things is, that's how under FDR we won the progressive reforms that we did in the New Deal. It was because there were millions of people who were in motion going on strike or fighting evictions or all the other things that happened in the upsurges of the New Deal era. And so whatever socialism is going to look like for in the future in this country, around the world, that is the route that we'll have to take to get there, is building up those kinds of forces at the grassroots level and workplaces and communities and in all the other ways that we know we need to build. And Bernie helped us see that, like, making that case was possible. So the socialism, my vision of socialism is obviously a very long ways off in this country. We have a long road to hoe before we get there. But we've seen that there, it's not totally impossible to imagine a scenario where people continue to be inspired in the way that they were by Bernie when they get involved more and more in social movements in their communities and their workplace, that we can actually transform the world together. And so Megan and I have a real optimism of our ability to do that going forward. We're all, you know, we're crushed by the end of the Bernie campaign, and we try to be sober about the basic fact that we've lost, and we lost badly, but we're on a path that could change the world. And we have a lot of hope in that. And we're thankful to Bernie for showing that such a thing is possible. And now it's up to the rest of us to actually build it.
And for those of us who do want to build it, your book is really a wonderful addition to the conversation and to the vision of this. Bigger Than Bernie, How We Go from the Sanders Campaign to Democratic Socialism. Micah Utrecht, by you and your co-author Megan Day, thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thanks for having me.
Micah Utrecht of Jacobin Magazine and the book Bigger Than Bernie. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.